This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Hollywood hopes the third time's the charm this summer, and so far so good. Spider-Man 3 set all kinds of box office records this past weekend, and that's just the beginning of a parade of threequels over the next couple of months. Shrek the Third, Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, Ocean's 13, The Bourne Ultimatum, and Rush Hour 3. And we're not even counting the new Harry Potter movie. Threequels give studios a chance to tap into a built-in audience and earn big, but there can also be pitfalls. Threes are often much more expensive than their predecessors and sometimes bereft of the pizzazz that established the franchise in the first place. In a bit, we'll talk to Murray Horowitz about the best and worst threequels of all time, and we'll begin with a look at the Darwinian struggle among this year's crop. So which, if any, of these pictures are you looking forward to? What do they tell us about the business? And do bad reviews matter? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, an acclaimed novelist tries his hand with a play. Thomas Keneally joins us. But first, threequels. And we begin with Kim Masters. She's the NPR arts and entertainment correspondent and joins us from our bureau in Culver City, California at NPR West. Nice to have you back on the program, Kim.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Spider-Man 3 studio Sony was a bit upset with you when you reported that this was the most expensive movie ever made at $350 million. They say it was a mere $270 million. But even if that higher number turns out to be right, they made it back in the first weekend.
Well, not exactly. They get to keep about half of that global gross, but they will make it back. They'll do very well. We never said they wouldn't make money. I had two gloating emails from the producer this weekend saying, ha ha, basically, and the other one said, you know, bet big and win big.
Uh-huh.
So they spent a lot of money, and they're going to make a lot of money. Arguably, they could have made more, but I think at this point, they're feeling pretty darn happy.
Yeah, you'd have to feel pretty good. I think the expectations are at this point, domestically, it will gross $200 million before next weekend starts.
That seems fair. I think they're going to revise those. They've been saying 148 for the weekend. I think they're going to tweak those up a little bit. It held very strongly through the weekend.
So that means the buzz on it was actually pretty good. You actually worry if Sunday's box offices are significantly lower than Saturday's.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you asked the question earlier, do the reviews matter? And obviously when a movie becomes an event like Spider-Man, the reviews don't matter. But, you know, word of mouth does. And yet, despite the fact that people, you know, had a lot of criticism of the movie and the critics kind of hated it, I think people just, they were ready for some fun. You know, they just went out and they just wanted to see those big effects, and Spider-Man delivered them.
Well, it's sort of an aside, but I guess bad reviews are almost a mark of a for sure profit.
Well, it seems so lately. Yeah. They hated Night at the Museum, and they're still counting that money.
They hated 300, and I guess we're going to have 301 next year.
Exactly. Yeah. it will cost at least that much.
At least that much. why is this? Why do these seem to be sort of insulated from the normal ebbs and flows of the industry?
Well, I think it is. It becomes an event, you know. They started the movie overseas this time, partly to preclude piracy and partly to generate the, oh my God, it was number one in Korea. You know, it was number one in Germany. And by the time it came here, there was this momentum. And I think, you know, I truly haven't talked to a lot of people in the industry. I think many of them were surprised. My numbers crunchers thought the movie might do 130, you know, and obviously it did better than that. But so I don't know why people are, what their postmortem is. I mean, I do feel to a certain degree that people were just chomping at the bit. There's been a lot of bad news. I mean, a lot of bad news. There's been a sort of a paucity of material in the marketplace the last few weeks. The movie was up against pretty much nothing. And people just said, the summer is here, we're going. And I wonder if you'd plugged in Pirates of the Caribbean 3 to the Spider-Man slot, whether it would have done the same business. I mean, who knows? But I feel that, for me, it feels like there was just a tremendous appetite to get out there and have some fun.
Well, that raises the question of what's going to happen when all of these big sharks are going to be swimming in the same pool together.
And that is the question that everybody, I mean, you know, to some degree, Hollywood is in an interesting position this morning of sort of gnawing on its own intestines and at the same time hoping that this augurs well. You know, they feel that they would like to have seen Spider-Man succeed possibly less not quite so dramatically, but they also hope that the tide will raise all the boats. So when we have Shrek in 2 weeks, and then we have Pirates a week later, and then we have Transformers, and then we have all these other movies that you mentioned, mm-hmm. I think they're hoping, they're certainly thinking this will be a record summer. The bad slump is over finally. Maybe they will make $4 billion in box office grosses. That's their hope.
But you're absolutely right. I guess the movie industry is one of the rare ones where they cast their own entrails in search of an augury.
Yeah, there really is a sort of a combination of Freud, Schadenfreude and just plain Freud.
Are there enough viewers to go around to make all of these a success?
I think a lot of people feel that it's sort of the conventional wisdom to say yes. And meanwhile, everybody's watching thinking, who will get dinged? Now, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who's the head of DreamWorks Animation, they have Shrek. He said, everybody will go see the three big June movies, which is Spider-Man, Shrek, and Pirates. But mine is only 81 minutes long. And these other movies are really long. They're both well over 2 hours, Spider-Man and Pirates. Now, the question is, does Shrek, people are sort of saying, yes, but Shrek, haven't we been there and done that? People like me who have a child say, been there and done that, going there and doing it again. So it'll be fascinating to see, how it plays out. But I think I do believe there is that appetite for a whole bunch of these movies. I can't see any of them doing poorly at this point.
Shrek the Third, 81 minutes, they better have a cartoon and a newsreel. It is a cartoon. I forgot.
Yes, with little kids, 81 minutes is good. In fact, for me, 81 minutes is good.
Let's see if we can get a caller on the line. If you'd like to join our conversation, our guest, of course, is Kim Masters, NPR's arts and entertainment correspondent. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And Catherine is on the line. Catherine calling us from California.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm going to make two comments, but I'd like to start by saying I saw Spider-Man yesterday, and I thought it was awful. And in spite of that being a threequel, I absolutely love threequels, and part of why I like it is very similar to I love HBO. I absolutely love it because I like to go back and see what's happening with the characters. It's sort of like a midlife version of soap operas.
Uh-huh.
So when I see Shrek, you know what's going to happen. You go to Pirates, you're waiting to see what's going to happen. I'm going to see all of them this summer.
You're going to see everything this summer.
Yep, see them all.
Kim Masters, Catherine, Hollywood hopes that everybody is like Catherine.
And I think many people will be. I mean, she's not discouraged by hating Spider-Man.
No, absolutely not. And again, HBO has got almost a movie quality feel to it with no commercials. And it's the same thing. You go, whether it's Rome or Entourage, you keep coming back each week because you want to know what happened. And like the new Bourne series, I'm definitely going to see that because I love that character and I know I can expect it's going to be great.
Thanks very much, Catherine. Have a good time at the movies.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Shannon in Lenexa, Kansas. I hope I got that right. My anticipation and desire to see threequels usually depends on how well the second movie followed the first. For example, the first movies of both Shrek and Pirates of the Caribbean franchises were very good. However, while Shrek 2 was just as funny, if not funnier than the first, the second Pirates movie was stunningly non-notable to me. Thus, I'm looking forward to Shrek 3 since I have confidence the director's actors will do it upright. Well, I don't plan to see the third Pirates movie. Kim, there used to be the rule that when these big, blockbusters, the sequel would always do a little bit, about three quarters, maybe two thirds as well as the original. Now that doesn't seem to hold anymore.
No, and interestingly, one of the reasons I was maybe expecting Spider-Man to be vulnerable is unlike Pirates, unlike Shrek, Spider-Man went down from the first one to the second one. Pirates went significantly up, and Shrek almost doubled from mm-hmm. one to two. And yet, for whatever reason, here comes the third one with terrible reviews and certain amount of bad word of mouth, if our earlier caller is to be mm-hmm. one of them. And boom, so this is why people are crazy in Hollywood, because that you think you have an idea of what might happen and then the opposite happens. Yeah. It's a really, really unpredictable business, as we've just seen.
Yeah, isn't there a famous producer who signed Nobody Knows Anything?
That was William Goldman, the screenwriter, and that is one of the truest things, especially about Hollywood, that's ever been said.
Let's talk with Steve. Steve's with us from Wichita in Kansas.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I like sequels. I like trequels. If I like the first movie, I'm a sucker for the next two movies. But what I see a lot of times, though, is that by the time the third movie comes along, it seems that all the big stars, all the big names want to get in on it, cash in on it, and sometimes the essence of the first movie is lost.
Mm-hmm. The quality does tend to drop down sometimes, and we're going to get more into this when we get Murray Horowitz with us in a couple of minutes. And by the way, if you've got a nominee for best or worst threequel in history, give us a call at 800-989-8255. But Kim Masters, Steve has a point.
Yeah, you know, but it doesn't matter. It has become eventized. I mean, it becomes this thing that you do because everybody else did it, I guess. It's really an interesting question for me is, okay, now Sony has already said, oh my God, we're so happy. We're making more and more. We'll make as many Spider-Men as the world can stand to see. Well, are they making them with or without this particular group of talent? Because between Sam Raimi, the director, Tobey Maguire, the star, and the other talent, the profits they are taking out of the movie before Sony gets a nickel will exceed 20%. So that's, and they're in a real strong bargaining position right now, I guess. So the studio has to decide, well, how much are we paying for this talent up front before you get into the whole area of the effects, which are hugely expensive and very unpredictable in terms of what the final cost will be. I mean, these studios go into making a movie like Pirates or Spider-Man with an idea in their head, a range of what the effects will cost. I don't think Sony went in to make a $350 million movie with Spider-Man. That's where I believe it ended up.
Hmm. When you start with a movie like El Mariachi, that went on to a prequel that is practically non-existent today.
I didn't even remember the sequel.
So, yeah, I didn't either.
Toronto was a great movie.
Ah, okay. Well, we go down to
that's
the...
Okay. Well, I liked it anyway.
All right. Here's a quick email from Sean in Cincinnati. I fear there's a summer threequel already being overlooked, The Bourne Ultimatum. For people like me who crave a little bit less fantasy on our action flicks, this is my most anticipated. What's the buzz about it, Kim?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know the buzz yet on the movie. It's really early. But I will say, I've been sort of, as I roam around on the internet and look at people's comments and posts and when we've written about these sequels, a lot of them are looking forward to that movie. So I think there is a tremendous appetite. It comes late in the summer when hopefully some of the carnage will be over and there'll be some room for Jason Bourne to get into the action again. And, you know, I think that there is, he's not alone. There are other people who are really looking forward to that movie.
Well, stay with us, Kim, if you will. We're going to come back and talk with Murray Horowitz to take your nominees for best and worst threequels of all time. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about movie threequels. This summer is full of them. Spider-Man this past weekend, Shrek the Third, Pirates of the Caribbean later this month, and of course Harry Potter in July. I think it's Harry Potter 5. Spider-Man raked it in at the box office, but reviews so-so at best, which raises the question, are third installments ever as good as the original? Kim Masters is still with us. She's NPR's arts and entertainment correspondent, and we want to hear from you. What makes a good threequel or a bad one? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. On our blog, we're taking your votes for best and for the bombs, npr.org/blog of the nation. And here with us in Studio 3A is our movie buddy Murray Horowitz. He's director and COO of the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center here in the Washington, D.C. area. And he's with us here in the studio. Always nice to have you on the program, Murray.
Always good to be here, Neil. Thanks.
So what makes a great third installment?
Well, there are trilogies, and we got to differentiate between things that have started out in order to make three.
Lord of the Rings, for example,
is a good example. And some of the best films in history, you know, there's the Indian masterpiece by Satyajit Ray, the Apu trilogy, and Marcel Pagnol did the Fanny and Marius trilogy. But those are different. Those are, you know, conceived as a threesome. I think you said it right. These are series, you know, where you start out with a film, and if the first film hadn't been a hit, second one wouldn't have been made. One of my favorite stories about this is one of the biggest films of its time, of all time up to that point, was The Sheik, starring Rudolph Valentino. And they made The Son of the Sheik, and had Rudolph Valentino not died about a week before. He died like the week before the movie was released, the sequel, so it was just giant, you know, riots in the outside the theaters and everything else. If he'd figured out a way to die a second time, they might have had a threequel to it, you know?
Well, if you talk about a list of the best threequels of all time, I fear it would be a very easy contest to predict. Here's a hint.
Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in.
Of course, Al Pacino in Godfather 3.
That's right. AFI Life Achievement Award honoree this year, Al Pacino. And, I'm one of the few people who has a really soft spot in my heart for Godfather Part 3. I think with some major, major flaws, it's a very interesting movie. And it did, Kim was right about saying how it's hard to predict what sequels are going to be. Godfather 3 actually, according to one source I consulted, grossed more than Godfather Part 2. But I don't know anybody who would argue that it's a better movie.
Let's see if we can get some callers. Kim, by the way, did you want to weigh in on this? What's your favorite threequel of all time?
Oh, gosh. I can't even begin to think of... I was trying to think of one that I liked. Let me think it over.
All right. Well, that vote on hold for later in the broadcast.
I am prepared with mine, but go ahead.
Oh,
anyway,
good.
let's talk with Elaine, and Elaine's with us from New York.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Elaine.
It's an honor. Thank you.
Oh, sure.
Well, I hope Murray is going to know what I'm talking about, but
I do too.
I'm struggling for the last name, Krzysztofski. A rouge, the French tricolor.
Right. Kieslowski, who is a Polish director, and that's a trilogy. That's Blue, White, and Red, I think, might have been the order in which they were released. And that's a trilogy. There were three parts conceived and three parts executed, and even had he not died, I don't think he would have gotten green or yellow or purple. But that's one of the great film trilogies of all time.
The movie Red was one of the most stunning, compelling movies I've ever seen, and I was devastated that the man died.
Well, he also did, speaking of a series, he also did an extraordinary series of movies based on the Ten Commandments. It's called the Decalogue, so he had 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. He didn't get up to 11.
Maybe on the Bill of Rights next time. Anyway, Elaine, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil. Thanks, everybody.
So long. There is also, we're told, going to be a fourth film in a famous series of pictures, one that starred Harrison Ford, and we're having problems with the tape. But I was going to go Indiana Jones.
Right, and that's one of my nominees for the threequel may be the best of them all. Certainly, Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, with all the father-son stuff with Sean Connery, and then I guess it's River Phoenix who's the young Indy, I think it's every bit as good as the first one. And one person on my staff says, no question, it's tons better.
Here's an email from John in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I nominate the third Matrix movie as the worst ever, epitome of running a unique idea into the ground for the sake of profit, painful to watch and, well, painful to listen to, but we've just got a little clip here.
What is he?
He is you, your opposite, your negative, the result of the equation trying to balance itself out.
And now you understand why it was such a terrible picture.
Well, he'll get an argument from a lot of people, me, and I really am. Part of my research was intramural in this one. My son, Alexander, works in the movies. Actually, full disclosure, worked on Spider-Man 3 and also on The Bourne Ultimatum in New York. And he said, he told me this story about Jaws 3D, which may be my nominee for worst ever. And that was reflected at the box office. But
you stole my thunder.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go.
Jaws 3D, worst picture ever made.
But do you know the story?
No.
Well, originally, it was conceived as a parody, as a self-parody, and was going to be called Jaws 3 People Nothing. But and Joe Dante, who directed Gremlins, was going to direct it. But the studio, I guess, chickened out, and they were left with the Jaws 3D.
Let's talk with Jay. Jay is on the line with us, calling from San Francisco.
How are you doing? Real quick. If I've got the sequence right, best threequel of all time is Goldfinger. I think that's
Thank
the
you.
Third.
Yeah.
And the worst is any title with Porky's and a number in it.
I don't think you were in the demo, but you stole my thunder there because, I think Goldfinger, had Dr. No not been a hit, there would not have been the subsequent Bond pictures. And Goldfinger, which is one of the best, was number 3.
Thanks very much for the call, Jay. Kim Masters, there are the blockbusters, and we've been talking a lot about Spider-Man, obviously, Batman, Superman, all those special effects movies would fall into that category. There are then these smaller pictures that find that niche audience, I guess like Porky's, and keep Well, I was going to say grinding him out, which might be an unfortunate choice of phrase.
Nicely Ew. Played, Neil Conan.
Yeah, well, if it can be made for a price, then it's worth it. You know, it's always a question of what does it cost and what is its upside. So if you, I don't know, I don't remember the talent from Porky's, but I assume
was there
they
any?
Were not commanding top dollar when they made that
And maybe
movie.
If they did, they would have been replaced.
Yes, exactly.
Actually, it was directed by, and I'm blocking on his name, and he just died last month.
Bob
Clark, thank you, who directed The Christmas Story, which is one of the great American comedies.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get Dinesh on the line. Dinesh with us from Iowa.
Yes. I would have to say, like, the greatest trilogy of all would be the original Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a geek, I can say that, but I have been since I was really little. And I was pretty excited when Episode 1 came out. I was about 11, and I went with one of my friends. And 30 minutes into it, we walked out.
Really?
If you can't capture a small child's, like, imagination, and it was just, I don't know, the three that have come out in the past 7 years, I think, have just been really, really bad.
Hmm.
How were you with Star Trek III, The Search for Spock?
What?
Do you know the Star Trek III movie? Because as a self-described geek, I wondered if you could give us an expert opinion on Star Trek III.
No, I'm not a Trekkie.
Oh, okay.
I'll step in on Dinesh's behalf. Not bad.
Not bad, Star
not
Trek
Not bad, Star Trek III, yeah. The second one was the better one. But
Which was the one with the whales?
That was 4, I think, or maybe 5. You know, I just lose track. The weird sequencing of the Star Wars picture, and let's play the requisite clip from the movie.
The Sith and the Jedi are similar in almost every way, including their quest for greater power.
The Sith rely on their passion for their strength. They think inwards, only about themselves.
And the Jedi don't.
Well, the filmmakers, Mr. Lucas in particular, this was a film that started out as he had a grand idea. But if the first one had not been a hit, would they have made the second one, Kim?
No, I mean, that was a shocking hit. Nobody could believe it. And he used that to extract one of the most famous deals in the history of the business and has since. You know, he owns pretty much everything. The studio gets a distribution fee and you know, it's still a lot of money, but George Lucas has enriched himself. And I think it's kind of a shame because those more recent ones were, I think, just stunningly bad. And it almost sort of retroactively diminishes, as with The Matrix, it kind of diminishes for me an experience that was great. And then you start seeing these sort of tired sequels and you think, boy, that kind of killed the experience.
Mm-hmm. And we must remember, Murray, he originally meant to make 9.
Yeah, so he said, but Kim's absolutely right. You know, when people talk, I was just mentioning this to somebody yesterday, when people talk about independent cinema and they love independent, I mean, all of the Star Wars movies since the first one have been indies.
Really? Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's independent cinema and there's independent cinema and maybe Total Control is too much.
Here's an email from Paul. The Austin Powers sequels. The first movie was a cute spoof of James Bond and other spy movies. The second was reduced to grade school children fodder. And the third movie, or threequel, managed to in some way or another be even worse than the second. I would have thought it impossible. It's as if they worked night and day on the third movie to best, or should I say worst, the second movie. So I'm not a fan necessarily.
Well, you know, that's a question I have for Kim. You know, these things do fall into sort of genres. Action films, a lot of sequels to action films. Horror films, you know, we're up to Halloween 86 or whatever mm-hmm. it is, you know. And then some comedies, particularly parody movies like the Wayans Brothers' Scary Movie. And Scary Movie 3 was a pretty good one.
And as soon as it's over, your phone rings. And a creepy voice says, you're going to die in
7 days.
What? Willie Mays?
I'm gay.
Who's gay?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, perfect.
It's still pretty funny.
So my question for Kim is not true of Spider-Man for sure, nor for Pirates of the Caribbean, but isn't there a way of studios like cutting costs for some of these cheaper movies because they don't have to do the same marketing? All they got to do is put another Roman numeral beside it, and they've got it done, kind of. At least
it's
that's
kind of.
Sounds like it to me.
It depends. I mean, first of all, there is that huge question of the cost of talent and how many effects are there. Those are the two big questions. Now, you look at Disney with Pirates of the Caribbean. They made 2 and 3 at the same time, and the idea was to save money. And they've basically said, we didn't save any money.
Yeah.
Because...
But you'd-
The effects, you know, it's you cannot predict. And the other thing to consider, maybe especially with a movie like Austin Powers, as the talent, and in that case, Mike Myers, a very difficult talent, moves into being this character, and their control becomes considerable and not necessarily for the good.
Yeah, and he, of course, cannot be replaced.
Not in an Austin Powers. I mean, I always think with Tobey Maguire, you know, they did fire him briefly off of Spider-Man 2 because he was being difficult and complaining about his back and possibly trying to get more money. And the rumor was that Jake Gyllenhaal was lined up to put on the suit. And I have to say, for me, I thought, why not? You know, I mean, he's got a mask on for most of the movie, and Jake Gyllenhaal looks like a young guy. Mm-hmm. I can't help but feel at Sony, aren't they sort of sitting there going, you know, I mean, would it really matter? But then again, that's the mystery of Hollywood. Would it really matter? I mean, do they want to take that chance and then blow possibly another, you know, $250 million opening? Who knows?
Yeah. It sort of didn't matter with the old Tarzan movies, you know, starting with Elmo
Bond.
Lincoln.
How about Bond?
And Bond. There have been different Bonds. But then there are these movies, and I think Ocean's 13, which we've barely mentioned, is an example of it. You know, it's like the Road pictures with Dorothy L'Amour, Bob Hope,
and Bing Crosby.
Bing Crosby. You know, the first one, which I think was the Road to Zanzibar, Road to Singapore, I guess, if that was a big hit. So then came the Road to Zanzibar and then World War II, and then they picked up after the war. But it was just, if you see those movies now, you wonder, what were they thinking of? But it was just a way for America to look at some of their favorite stars just having a great time, which is what the Ocean's 11 and 12 and 13 say to me. It's just like all these great stars like having a ball shooting in the south of France or wherever they are.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Murray Horowitz, director and COO of the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center in the Washington, D.C. area. Kim Masters, NPR's correspondent for our Arts Information Unit, Entertainment and Arts Correspondent, to be accurate. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We've been talking about big budget stuff. Here's one nominee from the other end of the scale. This an email from Ray in Sacramento, California. Don't forget Paul Morrissey's Warhol trilogy, Flesh, Trash, and Heat. Trash with the incomparable Holly Woodlawn is by far the best, one of my all-time favorites. As far as the best big budget blockbuster threequels is concerned, hands down, it has to be Back to the Future 3. Come on, a sci-fi western. It just doesn't get any better than that. I think he might find some arguments there.
Yeah, Ray. Especially from the studio, because that didn't do real well. And there were some real disasters. I mean, we mentioned Jaws 3D, and you know, Beverly Hills Cop 3 was not a big threequel.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible. One of the interesting things about this threequel, and you and Kim talked about what a big bet it was, betting big and winning big. This is on an extraordinary 4,200 and some screens. I mean, it's like something like 12 or 13% of all movie screens in America are showing this movie, Spider-Man 3, and that's a real big bet. This is like, you know, covering the earth with this movie, and it paid off.
Let's see one last caller. This will be Charlie. Charlie with us in Wichita, in Kansas.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Oh, this is interesting to listen to, and I thought, I racked my brain, and I thought, what are they leaving out? And I realized the Thin Man series.
Ooh. Yeah, we...
in 1934 through 48. Right.
Well, the first one is still much the best, but nevertheless.
Yeah. But they were consistent, that Woody Van Dyke directed them, and they were fast-paced and funny, and terrific chemistry between the stars.
And, Kim, when you've got these stars on contract, their demands can't go up every picture.
Yes, life was different. Those were the good old days,
well,
right?
William Powell made some demands after the war and some of the later ones, which are, I think, kind of sad. But you're right. And I think the threequel, which is alternately known as Another Thin Man or Return of the Thin Man in 39, is maybe one of the best in the series, I think.
Well, time, thanks very much for the call, Charlie.
Okay.
Time, Kim, now you've got to come up with your favorite.
I think I may have to go with a Thin Man just on the... But you know what? I think maybe I'll hold out for one that hasn't been made yet, which is Toy Story 3.
Toy Story 3.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Now that Pixar is back and Disney's plan for making it on its own has gone by the boards and Pixar's taking the reins, maybe Toy Story 3 will be my favorite.
What do you think, Murray?
I think that I have to tell you my favorite story about this, which, again, my son Alex told me. When they filmed the play, The Madness of King George III, most of the world knew it as The Madness of King George because distributors were worried that if they said The Madness of King George III, people were worried that they hadn't seen
and
King
they wouldn't go because they missed the first two episodes.
Right.
Yeah,
he was really mad.
But your favorite?
Oh, I think Goldfinger is, you know, really Because you'd go back to those James Bond movies and, you know, expecting to see the cars and expecting to see Q and expecting to see the gadgets. And then you ended up with a great title song. You ended up with Gert Frobe as the awful Goldfinger and Odd Job. And it sort of topped everything, even though I still think Joe Wiseman as Dr. No maybe my favorite villain of all the Bond ones. I love Goldfinger.
Well, Kim Masters, thanks as always for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Kim Masters with us from the studios of NPR West. And Murray Horowitz was here with us in Studio 3A. He is the director and COO of the American Film Institute Silver Theater and Cultural Center in the Washington, D.C. area. Murray, as always, thanks very much for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Neil. Thanks.
And when we come back from a break, we'll be talking with a novelist who, at the age of plus 70, has made the transition to the stage. Thomas Keneally joins us to talk about Either Or. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.